Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is an RNZ podcast.
He talked about just having sackfuls of money and he didn't know what to do with them. He'd stash them in his car, panels in his car. He'd leave them out in the garden. You know, he just said it was too much money. He just didn't know what to do.
Kia ora, I'm Jesse Mulligan. I'm host of the Daily Afternoons program on RNZ National. And you're listening to Crimes NZ. This is a series where I talk to people who are connected in some way or other with serious crimes that have happened here in New Zealand. In this episode, I speak to journalist David Lomas, and we're talking about Mr. Asia. Now, David has been covering this drug kingpin's crimes throughout his career.
In 79, I think it was, the Auckland Star sort of broke the story about the Mr. Asia drug ring. You know, Josh Easby, Sue McPherson and Murray Williams had done a lot of research and came up, and it was sort of a big breaking story because all of a sudden bodies were being found in Australia. But, you know, the Mr. Asia ring has actually been going 6 years by then.
Mm-hmm. Did they immediately use that name, Mr. Asia, that catchy name?
No, it came up a bit later. Oh, actually, they might have, actually. I'm sorry. I mean, I forget when things happened. Yes, I think somebody did dub. They called him Marty Johnson, who was then seen as the leader of the group. They, because they couldn't name him because he was still out
right.
there. They dubbed him Mr. Asia. Mm. Yeah.
And I imagine it would have spooked a few people in New Zealand. The fact that this was going on our shores.
Well, the thing then was it had actually left our shores by the time it all came to a head. I mean, Clark and Marty Johnson had been sort of operating for about 6 years. Johnson had started. He was a menswear clothing salesman down in Queen Street, but he sort of hooked up with an Asian seaman who was nicknamed Jack Chu.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Chu used to bring Buddha sticks in and he'd throw them off the boats as they came in through into Auckland. And Johnson would go out and pick them up and distribute them.
What are Buddha sticks?
Well, they're marijuana sort of wrapped up in little sticks. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And, you know, you could pick them up in Asia in those days for about 10 cents. But in Auckland, they were getting about $10. So, mm-hmm. You know, it was big money to be made. And what happened is Johnson and his another mate of his, Andy Ma, who was a Scotsman who was working in menswear too, they sort of got together and started this. And a bunch of old crims out, mainly who had met each other in Waitako prison down in Wellington, sort of hooked in on this. And one of them was a chap called Terry Clark. And he started sort of selling drugs, you know, which Johnson brought in. And then he sort of, he had great ambitions, and he and a bunch of criminals sort of all came in together, and they sort of took over almost from Johnson. Johnson was still there, but, you know, and it just spiralled and went on, as I say, for 6 or 7 years until all the murders started.
So who was Terry Clark?
Terry Clark was a small-time crim. He had done some burglaries, car conversions. He had tried to blow up a safe in Waipawa at the local TAB and almost blew himself up. He was inside and he sort of met a whole lot of guys in there. And as I say, when he came out, he hooked up with Johnston and Mr. Asia, and off it went. Clark was, you know, he was, what, 31 then? Johnston was 22, I think, when they met up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet any of these characters?
I never actually met Clark, but I almost met him one time. I mean, he had been convicted charged in Wellington with, I was based in Wellington at this time, of course. He was charged with importing heroin, and he had disappeared on bail to Australia for a few years and was caught. And he did, the trial happened in Wellington. Peter Williams got him off. Peter Williams and his associate, Karen Sowich, got him off. And that night they were celebrating in the Shaw Saville Hotel on Kemp Street in Kilburnie. And I was, our court reporter on the Dominion had covered the case, but I was sent out to try and catch the celebration. So I knocked on the door, and there were all these people who, unbeknownst to me, were going to go on and become quite famous as our sort of most notorious criminals. So,
well, but they came for a sit-down interview?
Sorry, no, not at all.
Was it a sophisticated operation?
No, it was more a stumbling, we'll do it, and they just did it. I mean, the start, Johnston had imported with the Thai Buddha sticks, and then in about 1976, after been going a couple of years, he took his father's boat to, or he got some people to take his father's boat, the Brigadoon, to Thailand, and they got 44,000, I think it was, Buddha sticks. And
I've got 450,000 here.
Well, it might be that. Sorry, my memory.
Well, we've used your notes, I should say.
They stumbled and bumbled their way. They got arrested for shoplifting in Noumea. They caught malaria. They went ashore in Indonesia, tried to get some help, and got arrested for not having visas. The boat broke down. They got towed. And the New Zealand police at that stage had a rough idea of what they were up to, but they lost track of the boat. And that came ashore up in Northland. They unloaded all the Buddha sticks. Clark and Johnston made about $3 million back in those days, which was an absolute fortune. And that set up what we sort of now know as the Mr. Asia drug ring, because Clark had a lot of money. He went to Australia. He set up there. Johnston decided that he had become an importer. He moved to Singapore and set up there. Auckland thug, called Peter Fulcher, took over the sort of New Zealand distribution, and it just went global.
So they headed to Australia at some point, eh?
Clark did, and he linked up over there with a chap called Robert Trimboli, who became quite notorious. There was an anti-drugs campaigner in Australia at that time, Donald Mackay, up in Griffith, and he disappeared, and later Trimboli was hooked up with killing him. But when Clark, through another New Zealand criminal who'd done time in Australia, Jimmy Shepherd, Clark met Trimboli, and Trimboli all of a sudden wanted to, he'd been doing marijuana out of Griffith, wanted to move into heroin importing, and with Clark, he found someone who could import it and import big loads of it. And Clark found a person who had money, banking skills, and also police informers, lawyers who could do stuff for him, and banking systems. So it sort of skyrocketed. And, over the next few years, Clark was bringing in absolute shiploads of heroin into Australia. I mean, one shipment, he hired an old fishing boat, the Conpira, and brought in something like 400 kilos of heroin in one load, and there were many loads.
Incredible. By the way, while we've got our expert on this case in, if you've got a particular question about the Mr. Asia case that you'd like answered, you can text it through. I'm speaking with David Lomas as part of our New Zealand Crime series. You mentioned Jim Shepherd. Can you tell us a bit of his story?
Well, Diamond Jim Shepherd, as he was sort of known, he was a little short chap, looked more like a jockey than a criminal, but he had been a bank robber and a burglar. I don't know everything about him, but he got the name Diamond Jim because he wore a big diamond ring on his finger. But he had hooked up with, he'd done time in Australia and hooked up with Trimboli, and he was the one who, as I say, connected Clark with the Australian, organised crime.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of stayed with the group and was basically the money man in a lot of ways, and also sort of Clark's number two.
At some point, he expressed some regret about the effects that this heroin had had on people.
Yes, quite a few of them did in the end. I mean, you know, over the years I've spoken to quite a few of them. Diamond Jim said, you know, when he went to prison again, I think in about mid-80s, he came across a whole lot of people and he thought, my goodness, you know, I've been responsible for creating this sort of mess.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, almost every name in this story has an interesting background. Do I have this right? You actually did meet Peter Fulcher.
Oh, Peter Fulcher, I got to know quite well. After the story had sort of died down, I always kept an interest in it, and I got hold of Fulcher one day. He was doing time down in Rangipo prison. I'd sat in on his trial in Auckland, where one of the couriers in the Mr. Asia thing had a woman called Alison Dine, who had been Clark's girlfriend at one stage, was giving evidence as a secret witness, you know, and had immunity. And anyway, I'd sat in there and watched that. Fulcher and a guy called Donnelly were both being done. Anyway, I contacted him in Rangipo prison, and he said, oh, yeah, come talk. So I went down and sat with him there and had a long chat. I went down a couple of times. And then when he started getting out on leave, he would give me a call and we'd have a coffee. And so over the years, I sort of dealt with him quite a bit. He was an interesting character. I mean, he told me that, you know, there was about 8 deaths in the Mr. Asia thing. And he said that, you know, given their occupation, you could say they all died of natural causes. So,
but, he know, told you some pretty amazing stories from those times. I mean, big loads of money, right?
Oh, he talked about just having sackfuls of money and he didn't know what to do with them. He'd stash them in his car, panels in his car. He'd leave them out in the garden, you know, dig up somewhere there. He just said it was too much money. He just didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Is he still around?
No, Peter, I spoke to him, it must have been, I think about 5 years ago, it might have been a little bit longer. He died of emphysema. And I rang him up just before he died, and he sort of gave a sort of deathbed interview to me and, you know, admitted most of the things which happened and talked about. He said he never actually killed anyone himself, but he was a party to or knew of. Mm. And, you know, like Clark's second wife, Norma Fleet, who was a drug addict, she died of an overdose, and everyone suspected she had been murdered. And Peter said, well, you know, I asked him directly, was she murdered? And he says, no comment, I know a lot about it. I'll pass on answering that one. But put it this way, I was one of the first people to know she had died. Mm. And I was the one who rang Terry to tell him that she'd died, and Terry just said, well, that's great news. So, yeah.
Davo says, yes, I remember Buddhist sticks from back in the day. They had a thin skewer of bamboo up the middle and were bound with a thin string of bamboo binding the outside. And I had an egg cup stuffed full of the skewers, rather strong cannabis compared to the stuff that they were growing in New Zealand. Thanks, Dave. Nice to hear from you. Somebody else wants to know about the lawyer you mentioned, Karen Soich, who is still around.
Well, Karen met Peter Terry Clark when she was working as an associate for Peter Williams in the 1978 trial in Wellington, when Clark, who had absconded from 1975, was brought back to New Zealand, was charged with importing heroin. Peter Williams got him off, or he got off because he was innocent, whatever way you like to look at it. Karen was the associate. She sort of fell for Terry Clark and sort of started going out with him and travelled with him. And when Clark was finally arrested in October 1979, I think it was, after he had ordered the murder of Marty Johnson, Soich was with him at that stage. She was, when the police burst into the house, I spoke to a policeman in England, Ernie Pemberton, who arrested Clark and Soich at the time. She said they were both in bed together, you know, when they burst in. Sowich jumped up stark naked and started yelling at the police. Clark, he said, lay in the bed and was very nonchalant about it.
Uh-huh. Some of this is ringing a bell, and I think it's because I watched the TV series Underbelly. Did you see that take on the Mr. Asia story?
Yes, I did it, and I actually did a bit of a review of it at the time.
Yeah.
As sort of a person who'd done a bit on the stuff. And,
right.
And, you know, actually, there's a classic question. Justice Stewart, who had done the Royal Commission of Inquiry on it, I rang him up and I says, what do you think of it, Judge? And he said, well, it's fiction, but it's mainly true.
Yeah. So. Great, love it. I'm speaking with David Lomas as part of our New Zealand crime series. Rachel, do you have a song here? We found a bit of an appropriate song, yeah. Are we going to do the dragon one?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, here it comes. Let's take a break. Said National, Any Fool Can Tell You by the band Dragon. David Lomas is in recalling the Mr. Asia case in New Zealand in the late 70s. A bit of a connection between that band Dragon and the case?
Yes, Dragon were... I went over to Australia in early 1979 to work with the Daily Telegraph over in Sydney were doing their coverage along with the coverage for the Dominion. And one of the names which came up very prominently back then was Dragon. A lot of them were sort of seen as being linked in with the drug scene and the Mr. Asia group. And in fact, one of the victims of the Mr. Asia murders, or Terry Clark's murders, was a guy called Greg Ollard, who was closely linked to Dragon. And Ollard was sort of seen, he was a dealer and he was seen as a bit of a junkie, and he and his partner, Julie Tielman, were both killed actually by Clark. I mean, he thought Ollard was trying to rip him off out of some money, as I understand it, and took Ollard out to the Kooringai Forest Park out of Sydney one day under the pretense of going to collect some drugs, and shot him in the back of the head. And then the next day he went back, and Julie Tielman was worried about him. And anyway, he said, well, I think I know where he is. And Julie was actually cooking some roast pork, apparently, that day. And so Clark sat round while she cooked, and he said, come on, let's go. We'll go and see if we can find your boyfriend, Greg. And they went out, and Clark had with him another chap from the syndicate who's sort of got name suppression on this part. Anyway, they took Julie out. Clark walked up and shot her in the back of the head a couple of times. And the other associate who was also a bit of a drug addict was forced by Clark to sort of dig a grave, put Tielman in, then forced to dig up the grave of Ollard and try and chop his head off and smash his teeth, so if he was ever found, that they wouldn't identify him. And this was all told to me by a chap called Carl Mengler, who was the policeman who inquired into all this. And Mengler says that Clark then went back to Tielman's house and ate the roast pork. But so I don't know if that's all true or not, but that's what the police told me.
Sounds pretty evil.
Apparently he was. He was... Clark was quite a ladies' man. I mean, people talk about him. He had a lot of charm and sophistication in some ways. And according to Peter Fulcher, I mean, his abiding interest in life was women. You know, he wanted money and women, and that was what he worked for.
How many other murders were there?
Well, sort of officially, they sort of link him to six, but it according to Fulcher, it's probably eight. And that's, so he killed three, well, he ordered the death of two people. That was two addicts who had been arrested with him in Brisbane in 1975 or 76. And they were talking to police, and Clark managed to buy the tapes of those interviews from the police through his connections from Trimboli. He spent about $100,000 or so buying those, and in those he heard that the Wilsons were talking about him, so he put a hit on them, and a guy called Basley killed them, and he was the guy who, everything sort of links around in circles, he was the guy who Trimboli had allegedly used to kill Donald Mackay a few years earlier, so... And so it's those two murders. And then Clark himself killed another guy, Pommy Harry Lewis, who had been arrested for, he was one of the dealers or traffickers, I get confused which one, but he'd been arrested. Clark thought he was about to talk. Clark posted his bail, which was $5,000. And then when he was driving back with him, shot him and left him in the bush again.
How do you get to, in a civilised country, just murder people and then carry on with your everyday life?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the big things that came out of the Mr. Asia was really how unprepared New Zealand and to an extent Australian police were for this sort of level of straight brutality and massive importation. I mean, the Mr. Asia ring was, in its own way, one of the forerunners of the big cartels from Mexico and all that. I mean, these guys just did it. And New Zealand police were so underprepared that, you know, they had an idea things were going on. And when they went to police headquarters, or bullshit towers, as the policemen used to call it, to ask for money to start investigating, they knew, for instance, there was a connection to Perth with boats travelling there. Mm. They were told, no, they couldn't go to Perth. And so police back then leaked the first details of the group to the Auckland Star, and that's where the Auckland Star started breaking the story. And then it was around that time the murders started happening, and it just skyrocketed. But, you know, in Australia, for instance, how did Clark get away with it? He was so brutal that he wanted people to know that he was killing people. Peter Fulcher in New Zealand said, you know, if you want to kill people, they're all on drugs anyway. You know, give them overdoses and nobody will know. And Clark said, no, I want it as a warning. And so when he killed, he made sure that people in his group knew that those people had been disposed of, because he wanted them gone and it was a warning to them. And equally in Australia with the Wilsons, because Clark had found out that they were talking, and same with Lewis beforehand, the people within the drug syndicate were too scared to talk to the police, because they knew Clark had insides into the police force and was getting the information back. And on top of it, he had good lawyers and people who were hiding the money, so everything, you know, nobody really connected him to anything.
How did it all end?
It ended with Clark had tried to expand into England. He had moved to England. He'd set up a great big drug deal with Johnson, who was based in Singapore. Johnson was meant to buy a massive load of drugs, which were to be shipped to England, where Clark had linked up with a bunch of local crims. Johnson got totally ripped off. He went into a meeting in some forest in Thailand, gave over a lot of money, and got a whole lot of flour or something like that in return. Johnson was called to England. Clark got Johnson's best friend, Andy Marr, the one who had started the business with him, told Marr that you either kill Johnson or I'll kill you. And so Marr met Johnson up in the border of Scotland and England, and shot Johnson in the back of the head. And then with another mate, a friend of his from Scotland, James Smith, they hacked the body up, tried to smash the face beyond recognition, cut the hands off, and threw the body into the Eccleston Quarry in near Chorley, I think it is, up in northern England. And they would have got away with it all, except they threw it and it landed on a ledge. And if they'd thrown it another metre or so away, it would have fallen to the bottom and probably never been found. But within a week or so, the body was found, identified, and Clark linked to it all. And so Clark was arrested, charged in England. It was the highest security trial in England to that date, and went for about 3 months. And Clark was convicted, and so was one of his New Zealand offsiders, whose name Errol Hinksman. They were both convicted. One of those things, yes. Mm. And Hinksman about drugs. And, of course, Marr and Smith were also convicted. And Clark was sent to Parkhurst Prison, and he died there. But according to Justice Stewart, the man who did the Royal Commission looking into it all, Clark was probably murdered by someone within the prison, because he was narking on people there, and the IRA were alleged to have done that.
Wow. And you have been involved in this case for over 30 years. No, over 40 years.
Yes, my goodness.
Any questions still unanswered?
There was a couple. I mean, the money. There was so much money. And it sort of evaporated, and you don't know where it's gone. I mean, Clark, you know, it was obvious things like Clark had the house up in Russell, and there was some property in Fiji, which was all sort of discovered, but it sort of vanished. And, you know, Trimboli being the bank man, and obviously he would have dealt with some of it. So where did the money go? That would be fascinating to find out. But the one that's always most intrigued me is Alison Dine, who was one of Clark's main couriers, one of the women who used to carry drugs in her suitcase, and went on to become his lover. She disappeared. She has disappeared. She gave evidence, as I said earlier, against Fulcher and other things. She got immunity from prosecution and guaranteed a witness...
Protection.
Witness protection and change of identity. And as I understand, she settled in England. She married. She had some sort of face changing, you know.
Wow.
And has never been seen since. I mean, her family probably know where she is, but they obviously don't talk. But she would have an amazing story because of all the main players, her and Jimmy Shepherd are the two left standing.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can find more episodes of this series on the RNZ podcast page or on Apple or Spotify or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. And if you like this series, you might also like the award-winning RNZ podcast series White Silence. You can find that one on the RNZ podcast page, along with all our other great podcasts.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.